I'm Lina Ahmadou. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we will look at some highlights of the Women Deliver Conference, which took place last week in Kigali, Rwanda. But first, a look at the issue of drug addiction. The United Nations warns that the cheap, easy, and fast production of synthetic drugs has radically transformed the illicit drug markets around the world with lethal results. Globally, more than 296 million people used drugs in 2021, which amounts to an increase of 23% over the previous decade. In Sao Paulo, Brazil, a new synthetic drug is puzzling authorities. It's called K9. It is very cheap and highly addictive. It is widely available throughout the central region of Sao Paulo. Edgar Maciel reports.
It's late afternoon in downtown Sao Paulo. On the floor, you can find what's left of the new drug that is haunting the biggest city in South America. These are vials of K9, a synthetic drug made by drug dealers in a laboratory. On the streets, users are caught in a zombie state. Looking from outside, it looks like their brain froze and left the body paralyzed. This year alone, 102 people were treated for suspected cases of intoxication by synthetic cannabidiol in Sao Paulo. There are still no published scientific studies detailing the consequences of its long-term use. We visit this laboratory in a university in Sao Paulo to understand the addictive power of this substance. It is called synthetic cannabidiol because it activates the same brain regions as THC, the main component of marijuana.
This group of synthetic substances is among the disturbing drugs. The hallucinogenic effect is very fast. It has a mixture of stimulants and depressants that brings up this disruption that people have. And it gives these effects of the person not being able to speak, many times looking like a zombie, eyes still.
According to the police, this drug was first detected in prisons, mostly dominated by a criminal organization that operates from within the Sao Paulo State Penitentiary System called Primeiro Comando da Capital, PCC. Now, K9 has spread to the streets because it's very cheap, which makes it accessible even to the homeless. Weekly police raids lead to arrests of traffickers and discovery of new laboratories where K9 is manufactured.
Due to the emergence of the drugs, we started to target the labs and not just the big drug dealers in Sao Paulo. It doesn't have a defined formula. There are a lot of people doing it, and each one mixes with a certain amount, one more ingredient.
K9 spread through Cracolandia, a region in downtown Sao Paulo, completely dominated by drug users and sellers. Groups of addicts mill around the area looking to buy drugs. This has brought fear to downtown residents who have been dealing with insecurity, including robberies. Removing users from the center is transferring the problem to other parts of the city, according to security specialist Guarasi Mirad.
There is no magic formula, and it needs to be worked on for a long time. Every time you do an operation, you spread it, spread where the user is, where the supplier is. You need to work hard to reduce it. How are you going to do this? There are no people for that. Working like this is drying ice.
Meanwhile, users agonize. In Igreja da Sé, the biggest Catholic church and one of the city's monuments, while people pray inside, this man begs for water, but he can't even move his body from the floor. Sao Paulo continues its war against drugs, but analysts say this could be a losing battle.
The International Day Against Drug Abuse was commemorated worldwide on June 26th. On this occasion, the anti-drug agency in Nigeria has organized a street walk in Jos, Nigeria, to sensitize youth on the dangers of drugs. Anti-drug officials and participants shared their thoughts on drug addiction in their community and what they think can be done to help those who are struggling with addiction.
Every year, the United Nations has set aside June 26th of every year to commemorate and sensitize indeed the international community on the dangers being posed by drug abuse and illicit trafficking. Today's date is set aside to sensitize and enlighten people to understand the grave dangers inherent in the abuse of drugs. All drugs are notorious. They all have the capability of fueling insecurity. They have the capability of inciting violence and all kinds of insurgency, kidnapping, and all forms of social vices we are witnessing today. In Plateau State here, from January to date, in this month of June, we have succeeded in seizing over 605 kilograms of various illicit drugs and almost over 600 suspects.
They need help. So we need institutionalized help. We need personal help. We need community help in terms of where the community plays a role through its socialization structures, masjid, churches, elders. And then we need our health system to vastly improve in terms of what's available in terms of health care.
The religious bodies, whichever faith we're talking about, must know that it's their responsibility to step in and help deal with this matter spiritually, morally, from the religious perspective. And then, as a family, we must also be ready to give support.
Part of the unemployed Congolese youth consumes a cheap and artisanal drug called Bombay. It is made from the residue of the exhaust pipes vehicles. Modeste Kambagala, pharmacist in the DRC, explains the reasons and risks of consuming this drug.
This is a homemade drug that is very potent, used by young people who, according to the information we have, use the substance extracted from the exhaust pipes of vehicles as a catalyst, to which they then add tablets of acid, prostadine, or tramadol, a fine powder crushed to inhale, which gives them an instant effect. This bomb drug used by these young people just to have fun, sometimes to escape the pain or the harshness of their precarious social life, is a public health problem that worries the authorities. The consequences are severe for the society. We deplore the acts of urban banditry perpetrated by these young people. Once they have taken this drug, they take up machetes and engage in fights, doing all sorts of things with no feelings or pity. It is of great concern to the community as they cause public disturbance and disrupt the peace. To fight effectively against the phenomenon, we need collaboration between the health authorities and the police. But above all, it is critical to limit these distribution channels of the substance. We have seen a decrease. The authorities have made a lot of effort. The police have made a lot of effort to be able to track down these young people. And therefore, this phenomenon has significantly decreased.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security is exploring ways artificial intelligence can help detect fentanyl and prevent it from entering the country. VOA's Julie Tabu has more.
The U.S.-Mexican border is an important gateway for the flow of people and commerce, but it's also increasingly vulnerable to the surge of illegal smuggling of dangerous drugs like fentanyl. To address this growing concern, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas in April announced the creation of a new task force.
Drug trafficking organizations have grown in sophistication and power.
Among other things, it would look at ways artificial intelligence can be used to detect and counter the flow of illegal drugs into the country.
We will explore using this technology to better detect fentanyl shipments, identify and interdict the flow of precursor chemicals around the world, and target for disruption key nodes in the criminal networks.
Pat Simmons, a former director at U.S. Customs and Border Protection, says there are systems on the market today which could be further enhanced with AI. One example is something called the Muon Tomography System, which can produce a more accurate image of the object that's being scanned compared to the X-ray technology currently being used.
If there's dense cargo in there, X-ray can't penetrate it. So if you use a Muon tomography system, it can penetrate and does, and allows the officers to see exactly what's inside of a dense object.
Simmons says the system can also help the task force use AI to identify the precursor chemicals that go into the creation of fentanyl.
You'd have to teach the AI what it is you're looking for. So you would get some of these precursor chemicals that are coming in from China by the boatload, and you would teach this system through thousands of scans, so it would begin to realize what it's looking for.
Another way AI can help is in intelligence and predictive analytics with vehicle crossings at the border.
Who are the people that are coming across? How often do they come across? And then also the vehicle and the license registration. How often are they coming across?
AI can be deployed to detect fentanyl that has been pressed to look like candy or legitimately manufactured prescription pills. The AI task force is due to report their findings to Homeland Security in the coming months.
Palorinia Refugee Settlement in Uganda is reporting high numbers of suicides and suicide attempts by the people who live there. Organizations and individuals who work with the refugees say denial of food and a failure to meet basic needs are the main causes. Halima Atumani reports from Obongi District, Uganda.
Since the start of this year, the Lutheran World Federation, a non-profit working with refugees in the Palorinia settlement in Uganda's Obongi district, has recorded one suicide and 20 attempts by refugees. 18-year-old James Wubam came to Palorinia with his uncle. He says his uncle's wife would deliberately deny him food. He also said he found it difficult to ask his uncle for basic needs, including school requirements. He doesn't have any siblings to share these issues with, and this has put him in a deep depression.
I thought of hanging myself. I went to a local club with my friends and consumed some alcohol. When I got home, I contemplated suicide.
Isaac Oturi, a clinical psychologist with the Lutheran World Federation, says most of the 20 suicide attempts so far this year involved young people triggered by unmet needs.
In a settlement here, people are, their hands are tied. You survive only on the given items. Now you can't make it for yourself. Now to make it worse is that even those who are in position to work, there's very few or less or minimal livelihood opportunities that would help them to earn a better living.
Michael Gale said that when he found out that his name was listed under those whose families would not get food, his wife left him. Left to fend for four children, he contemplated a quick escape.
They will call you Baba when they want to eat, but there is no food, there is nothing. I cannot go find labor work from people. I sit in one place. It is too much, and it is better for me to hang myself.
To ensure each case is attended to in time, agencies have set up para-counselors, also known as suicide gatekeepers. With little funding and just one clinical psychologist in the settlement, many victims do not get the support they need. Halima Athmani for VA News, Obongi District, Uganda.
You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. When we return, we will look at the world's largest gatherings on gender equity and sexual and reproductive health. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis, inviting you to listen every week as a panel of VOA and Washington-based journalists discuss the top domestic and international news stories. With our correspondents and sources from the White House, Capitol Hill, and elsewhere, we will bring you the inside stories from Washington. That's Issues in the News every week on The Voice of America.
Welcome back to Health Chat. Women Deliver is one of the world's largest gatherings on gender equity and sexual and reproductive health and rights. This year's Women Deliver Conference on Spaces, Solidarity and Solutions hosted tens of thousands of people attending online and about 6,000 others showing up in person, say conference organizers. Those attending the four-day conference focused on advancing gender equality and reframing who leads. Corporate lawyer-turned-entrepreneur Monica Musonda is CEO and founder of Java Foods, a Zambian-based food processing company and one of the presenters at this year's conference. Musonda talked to VOA's Carol Van Dam about what motivated her to start her own company and about the objectives of the Women Deliver Conference.
We're really happy, first of all, that it's been held on the African continent and has been able to bring women from all over the world and also all spheres of influence. So you have NGOs, you have women in business, you have government officials all here discussing how we can further enhance women equality, issues related to women in business, how we can really enhance policy and things of that nature.
Tell us a little about Jabba Foods. And I know you were a corporate lawyer and now you're an entrepreneur. So how did that all come about?
Sure. So I'm a trained corporate lawyer. Had worked for 16 years all across the world, advising corporates on various things. And I'm originally from Zambia. And it really dawned on me towards the end of my career that I actually was not doing something in my own country. And I really asked myself the question whether I wanted to continue to impact my country through law or would it be something else? And when I visited, I realized that actually we needed probably a lot more support in manufacturing, in particular in food processing, where we found on shelf a lot of times a lot of imported products. And for me, what was front and center coming from Zambia was that Zambia grew food very well. Yields on a year-on-year basis were very strong, but we didn't process it. So we didn't put it in a packaged form for the consumer to buy. And there I saw an opportunity to really create products which were made from locally sourced raw materials, packaged very well at an affordable price point for a Zambian and a regional consumer. And that's where the business idea came from.
I think a lot of people can take hope from you because I think that's the situation with a lot of countries in Africa where they have the raw materials and they have the food. They just don't have the manufacturing.
That's absolutely right. So it's not a unique issue for Zambia. And in fact, you'll see coming out of COVID and this crisis in Ukraine, that now we've been really highly impacted because imports were now becoming really more expensive. And the crisis was now becoming a food crisis very quickly. And therefore, the need and the discussion of governments to speak to business to say, how can we actually produce more local foods for our people, which are much more affordable? So sometimes in crisis, there's a silver lining in everything. And I think that conversations are now are picking up and are being much more inclusive. And that's why you see me as a CEO of Jabba Foods still being here because of really strong focus towards more food production in our own countries.
Talk about being a woman CEO in your country. And did you face obstacles in getting your company off the ground?
So, yeah, I think I did. I mean, obviously, in an industry which is not used to seeing women running a business, coming up with a business idea, putting a team together and growing a business, manufacturing all across the continent is really dominated by multinationals or by men, simply put. So I was a bit unusual. And oftentimes people didn't take you seriously. So access to market was very difficult. A lot of people figured that I wouldn't be around. So why waste your time on me? I didn't really know what I was doing, and sometimes they were right. I mean, very early on, you were still feeling the ground and trying to figure out how to get product to market, how to price it. But I'm no different from a man who would start out the business, right? But definitely the critical aspects were that at the time, although I was a qualified lawyer with many, many years of experience, people weren't willing to bank on this new business in a new sector, in an area which they were used to seeing other people. So raising finance was very difficult for me. I had to use personal money to grow the business. And it took a few years. I actually think it took a lot longer than it should have to actually grow the business because it was just that much harder.
What do you hope to do to help other women achieve the kinds of things that you have already been able to do?
So actually, I do a lot of things, and I think it's great platforms like this to speak to you about what I've done, but also going to conferences like We Deliver, but also being a part of what we call AFAWA, which is under the African Development Bank, which is a group of women entrepreneurs and ambassadors who are now speaking using our voice and their platform to tell women across the continent our journeys to come together to discuss innovative ideas. Because today, actually, we cannot say you shouldn't finance women-run businesses, because they have been actually successful.
That's Monica Musonda, CEO of Jabba Foods and a speaker at the 2023 Women Deliver Conference in Zambia. She was speaking to my colleague Carol Van Damme from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. For more on Women Deliver, I spoke with Myra Betron, Director of Gender with the organization JPICO, and Elizabeth Doggett, JPICO's Technical Coordinator on the conference.
So Women Deliver, of course, as you said, is a huge conference. There are a lot of themes across the conference, and this year we had participation from various groups, from government level to civil society organizations to donors and private sector. So I think that's what was exciting, is that there really is such a big momentum now to promote gender equality across sectors. And there isn't so much a question of whether we should be doing this, at least by, I think, a pretty good sort of critical mass working in health and international development programs. And so now, you know, we are seeing more donors saying that this is something that we have to prioritize. So I think that's exciting. But another really key takeaway, and was really a theme of the conference, is that we need to really mobilize women-led organizations and feminist movements in the countries that we are working with in the Global South to really harness their voices and let them lead in the health and development agenda. There are, of course, a number of other major themes, such as reflections on the importance of sexual and reproductive health rights and bodily autonomy, which is something that we are certainly working on extensively in our programs at JPICO, especially in our gender programming. Also, much more attention to the critical issue of climate change and the need to promote gender justice in that space. As well as, I think, what was a little bit newer for me with this Women Deliver, and I think I appreciated, especially from the work that I have been working on here at JPICO and prior to my work in JPICO, is the need to also really engage men in promoting gender equality.
And Elizabeth, when you look at the Women Deliver Conference, and you were the technical coordinator for JPICO, what stood out to you, or what were some of the very pressing needs that were on your agenda going into the conference?
Absolutely, and certainly echo everything that Myra has already said, but wanted to also highlight that this is the first time the Women Deliver Conference has been held in the Global South, and of course also the first time it has been held in Africa likewise. And with that change, there was lots of discussion about decolonizing development, or calling for power shifts in the relationships between funders from wealthy countries, largely in the global north, with grassroots organizations and lower and middle income countries. So these discussions were calling for more accountability for local and for funders and high income countries, as well as more trust in the abilities and work of local and feminist groups. These kinds of discussions were also challenging the way certain kinds of knowledge making have been traditionally held. So, for example, placing more value on empirical and quantitative knowledge over the knowledge that comes from experience.
Now, Myra, part of the programs of JPICO involve gender-based violence. Talk to us about that and how that was part of the dialogue during the conference.
Yes, so certainly gender-based violence is a very critical topic. I always say that it's really the most egregious form of gender inequality, in my opinion. And there were a number of panels and sessions, and sessions focused on other topics such as gender and technology, but very much still the relevance of gender-based violence emerged in terms of online sexual harassment, et cetera. So I think, you know, for us, this is an area that we have been working on for about the past decade now. And it's really, I think, heartening, as much as this is a difficult topic to talk about, that there is more increased attention and really funding towards addressing sexual and gender-based violence, as well as child early forced marriage, which is very much in many cases, and I think what really those of us working on gender equality agree, is a form of gender-based violence. So we are seeing that it's critical to work not just on response, but really addressing the root causes in terms of norms that really predicate or put women in a lower, a much lower status that allow these different forms of violence to occur. And so in addition to that, you know, there was definitely a call for more laws and policies that are supportive of doing this work. And I think those structural changes are really what's needed to reach that tipping point to end these forms of discrimination against women.
When you take a program on gender-based violence and you take it to countries, to communities, what model works from your experience with the organization?
What works? So I'll speak to perhaps some of the very specific programs that we presented actually as part of an online global dialogue, because certainly I think there is no one approach that works. It definitely requires a multi-pronged, multi-sectoral approach. And in fact, that's what we talked about in our online dialogue, which is the importance of a multi-sectoral approach to preventing and responding to gender-based violence, and really multi-level. So working not just in the homes or communities, but really working with institutions to create an environment that holds perpetrators accountable and support survivors, as well as has laws that really emphasize that. So our program in Nigeria, for example, does take that broader ecosystem approach. We are in health facilities screening and identifying women that are experiencing violence, but also in the community, training community leaders to really support women and link them to services, as well as mobilizing just everyday activists to talk about and challenge the acceptance of violence against women and child early forced marriage, and then working with governments from local government to the national level to revise and update policies and action plans. So really that multi-pronged, multi-level approach is essential.
How do we engage men and masculinities? You touched on it earlier. When we talk about gender-based violence, men are very much part of it. How do we make them part of the solution?
So I will borrow a phrase and framing from one of the evidence-based interventions that we are implementing in our program in Nigeria, which is SASA in Swahili, that stands for now. And it is also an acronym for the four-phase approach to the intervention, which is start, awareness, support, and action. And their emphasis is really benefits-based activism. So there's no finger-pointing or coming at it with sort of stigma of blaming any individuals or men in particular, which can be quite off-putting, but really trying to look at how we can use power positively in our relationships and our communities for a better life for everyone. So that's how we engage men. And another important way to engage men is really to get them to think about the positive outcomes for their family and promoting gender equity in their households in order to really have positive outcomes for their children and their family more broadly. So we are adapting a few interventions on that as well. And that's in not only Nigeria, but a few countries in Guatemala, in Cote d'Ivoire, as well as Togo.
Elizabeth, now to you. Speaking of gender, JPEGO has a gender transformative leadership toolkit. What does it consist of? What is it?
Absolutely. So gender transformative leadership is a training curriculum with an audience intended to be with health workers, although it can be used in different kinds of team and professional settings. This toolkit was developed several years ago in our Liberia program at JPEGO. And it's about women's leadership, but it goes a step further to teach teams how to identify and address patterns in the workplace that disadvantage women. But many of us argue those same patterns harm every worker. These are issues like implicit bias, family-friendly work culture, how women and men communicate with each other at work and on teams, mentorship and allyship. Those are some of the examples that the curriculum covers. And we're hoping to expand this into other contexts as well.
Myra Bertrand and Elizabeth Doggett with the organization JPIGO. That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For more health news and medical breakthroughs, visit voaafrica.com. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lenore Moudou in Washington. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.